Hi, this is Tom Oliver from Oliver Cider and Perry in Ogle Pitchard, Herefordshire, England, and you are listening to Cider Chat.
And this is episode 105. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Aria Wincoller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. And this week, we are in for a special treat, as we'll be hearing from Tom Oliver of Oliver's Cider and Perry, based in Herefordshire in the UK. And it'll all be on Perry. There'll be more on that chat in just a moment. Ooh-wee, it is so good to be chatting with you this week. Last week, I had shoulder surgery, and that was a trip, and it's really successful. Typically, I guess a lot of my friends were freaking me out, saying, watch out, you're going to be in so much pain. And I finally told people to stop already. I don't want to hear that. I felt so positive to be able to have the opportunity to have surgery. And I went in there and I just loved the nurses and the doctors. And it was just like a love fest really for me. I try to move through life like that because I have the saying, when working towards success, there's no time for failure. And I try to actualize that in my own health and in my daily life on whatever I'm doing. So whether it's health that is the little stress factor for you, or you are a startup cidery or thinking about becoming one, or you're full in on it and wondering how you're going to make it, yeah, keep that eye on the prize. When working towards success, there's no time for failure. You know, life is short, so you might as well stay in the success channel if you can. And if you can't, seek out people who will shine that light for you. Because again, no time to waste here. So I'm feeling great, really stoked to be here. I'm doing this podcast one-armed, which is enlightening. Luckily, I am ambidextrous. So that's good. But you know, I'm missing my right arm, but it needs a little bit of care. I'm a little tired. And I need a lot of rest. So we're going to just keep on rolling through this show and move us up to the main chat with Tom Oliver. I'll be right back. We're going to fill in a couple details and then roll into the main chat in just a couple moments.
You got to grab that luchi. You got to bust that thing. Get your kicks on the street. Gotta kick back, step back. Oh, you got to skeet. It's a rat-a-tat-a, 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 bala. Rat-a-tat-a, 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 holla. I don't wanna be pushed like I do the push. When it comes to the cheddar, keep it under the cushion. I don't wanna be ganked like I do the gank. When it comes to the cake, beat me, you think. I don't wanna be pushed like I do the push. When it comes to the cheddar, keep it under the cushion. I don't wanna be ganked like I do the gank. When it comes to the cake, beat me, you think.
Alrighty, a little bit of updates here. First of all, I want to thank William, who just became a patron of Cider Chat. Howdy doody, William. He is a listener of Cider Chat, of course, because that's why people do support this podcast. And he did that through Patreon, which is a website that helps content creators like myself keep this chat thriving and surviving. So thank you so much, William. I also want to thank Joby, who gave Cider Chat a new handheld recorder. And I'm actually recording on it right now. I'm hoping it's working, sounding good. I'm trying to work out the little wiggy things on it because I'm not super techy. It takes me a while. And this is so much different than my other recorder, but I feel like Shazam because now we have a backup recorder and that's something I've been really working for, and that's building up the podcast and bringing better quality to you. So you might hear variations of audio as I go on here. Thank you again, Joby, so much. Wow, what a gift. And because of Joby, this week's episode with Tom Oliver was able to be recorded because he actually had the recorder there at Cider Days that took place the first weekend of November in Franklin County, Massachusetts. He had it there and recorded the Saturday workshops that he was able to attend. And then Al Sachs, who you'll hear in just a moment, introduce Tom Oliver. Al then had my recorder for Sunday of Cider Days and recorded some of the workshops also with Tom Oliver. And I haven't really listened to them all, so I'm not sure what Al has gotten to yet. But that was fantastic because I was on the West Coast, for those of you who have been following along my travels, recording with Robbie Honda and Jake Mann and Rider Ranch. Those are cider makers out in the hills of Santa Cruz Mountains, also Cider Junction. So I was doing that, but there was two recorders, so we got to get an inside scoop for those of us who couldn't attend Cider Days. So amazing. There is just so much good feeling in Ciderville. I'm overwhelmed by it. So that I wanted to tell you about. And then the other piece is I will be at CiderCon. Now, what is CiderCon? It's really a trade event. And I know a lot of folks listening are in the trade. So if you are there, I can't wait to see you. Probably won't be shaking your hand necessarily because of my arm. I have to watch out for that. But that's going to be held at the end of January. Let me see. The dates of that are January 30th to February 2nd. So really, it's like a Wednesday to Saturday piece there. And on Tuesday, they're going to have some tours. One is going to be through Washington, D.C. Another one's going to be in Maryland and then in Pennsylvania, you know, around the region of where CiderCon is going to be held in Baltimore. So I'm going to be talking about CiderCon all the way leading up to it to get us all in the buzz on it. And those of you who get to attend, you know what I'm talking about. And even if you can't attend because you're not a commercial maker or this is not the kind of event that you would go to, I think there's a lot to be learned about it in terms of what they are setting up for workshops. And that's what I hope to share with you. So stay tuned for that. And my tip this week for anyone even thinking about going to CiderCon is to reserve your hotel room now in Baltimore. They have a registration online. The website's ciderassociation.org, or just Google CiderCon, that's con, C-O-N, and get that set up now, because sometimes I don't know if this is impossible. I don't know how big the hotel is, but you want to make sure you get a room. You could always cancel it, but start planning now. Okie dokie. All right. Well, we're going to move into this main chat with Tom Oliver. And again, it was pre-recorded. You're going to hear Al Sachs doing the intro. Al Sachs was on the podcast. He is, I guess, on the board, you would say, of Cider Days. So he helps set it up. And Al's a great guy. I know him, just as a local yokel. He was a DJ for many years. I remember he had me on his program. It was like a community radio station at the University of Massachusetts, and he did a fantastic show and had me talking about Cider Days way back when. So, you know, we've been running in the same pathways for years. And so you'll hear a little bit about him, and we're going to roll into it. But I want you to think about something while you're listening to Tom Oliver, in that coming this April, I'm going to be in the UK meeting with Tom Oliver and a bunch of other amazing cider makers, being shuttled around through Herefordshire and Somerset and experiencing cider during apple blossom season. So we're talking late April, April 25th to May 2nd. We're going to be going to two ciders a day. We're going to be having cider meals, cider themed meals, like indulgence, getting in the groove of the landscape, of the people, of the local fair, and learning from each other, from the makers, walking in the orchards. I believe it's a really well-paced tour because I curated it with everyone in mind that wanted to have a cider experience. So if you're listening to this and you think you want to go on that trip, do reserve your seat now, because this is the first Totally Cider travel tour going out into the world. And I'm hoping there's going to be many. And one way you could support this podcast, if you can't be a patron, is to share the news about this tour. Because my hope is that this will be one of many tours, not only in the UK, but also in the US. You could be sure that I am scouting out, well, loops around the US right now to bring cider tourists, hopefully to your cidery or to your cider bar. And that's a way we help each other, is by lifting all cider up. And I would think that you would say, you know, dang, so Rhea's not going to my neck of the woods of Ciderville on this trip, but I'm hoping she'll come and I could support Cider Chat and this new venture that she's trying to do to keep the podcast sustained by letting people know that. So I'm going to be putting up a sign. I'll be reminding you. I can't do it right now because of the one arm, but I'll be putting up a sign at the totallycider.com page that you could download if you're a cider or a cider bar, and put a little poster up. So I'm going to be working on that and won't be live on the first day of the podcast going live, but it's going to be live between now and a week from now. And you could just go to totallycider.com, download the little like PDF thing, and put up a flyer and let people know. Because I'd like to fill this up so that I can move on to the next tour that I have planned. And it might just be coming to your spot in Ciderville, which I think this is grand to get folks really being moved towards where the cider is. And in turn, it just keeps on, you know, building up the momentum and excitement of cider. So think about that while you're listening to Tom Oliver, as he's talking about the different places, his location, the folks who have visited there, and imagine yourself hanging out with Tom Oliver, walking out in the orchard, drinking Perry with him, having a cheese pairing, because he basically said, this is the only way I want to do it, is by having a tasting of cheese and Perry. And of course, what am I going to say? Hell yeah. So if that sounds like amazing time with you, plus all the other makers we're going to be seeing, do again, reserve your spot today at the totallycider.com webpage, and you won't regret it. Let's all now grab a glass and join this chat with Tom Oliver of Oliver's Cider and Perry, based in the UK. Remember, this is a pre-recorded at Cider Days 2017, and will be brought into this conversation by Al Sachs.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Cider Days again. This is one of the workshops that I've been pushing for a number of years, because I believe that Perry is one of the most exciting drinks that's coming into the United States. Of course, it's been known in England for hundreds and hundreds of years. And the person that I associate with making the best Perry in England is Tom Oliver. And we are honored to have him here today. And you are so lucky to be here. I can't believe it. My hero, Tom Oliver, one of the best cider and Perry makers.
Thank you very much, Al. I don't really believe that myself. And I am just another cider and Perry maker in a room full of cider and Perry makers, in a town full of cider and Perry makers, in a country full of cider and Perry makers, and luckily in an ever-increasing number throughout the world. So I think that's something to celebrate in itself. I want to thank Franklin County Cider Days committee and everyone for asking me back again to waffle about cider and perry. It's nothing I prefer doing more than talking about it. No, actually, I prefer drinking it, to be truthful. And to that end, I'd like to say, for those of you who are coming tomorrow to the Perry tasting, you're lucky because it's sold out. For those of you who can't come tomorrow, we've managed to scratch together two very, very fine Perrys for you to have a taste of today while I talk. Because believe you me, having a little bit of Perry while I talk is a very good idea. So. The first one is from my very good friend stood in the corner, Mr. Ryan Burke, who's made a very fine perry at Angry Orchard. It's 2016 fruit, and it consists of gin and butt perry pears and a pack of pear, and it's bottled dry. It has a soupçon hint of condition to it, and it's a lovely perry. And I don't particularly like it myself. The reason is, he beat me in the competition in England. So, you know, enjoy it at your peril. It's lovely. We're not going to do anything formal. Lauren's just very kindly going to hand out bottles, and in an honour pour system, please pass it around. Pass it to your neighbour, just take a little, and I hope there's enough for everyone. James Crowden, he's a fine cider poet and author, and he said, if cider is a hard master, then perry is his beautiful but fickle mistress. You never know what perry is going to do. It's a defiant rule breaker of immense charm, brilliant one moment and woeful the next, destined to pull quirky stunts. You can never stop learning, though, because when it is right, it is a magnificent celebration of the wonderful subtleness and delicacy of the perry pear. The aroma that can hint of a hedgerow fruit such as elderflower. The taste laced with a citrus zing against a body of apricot and touches of rhubarb, ginger or lychee. All this anchored by the stunning attention-grabbing tannic experience in the mouthfeel and in the finish. And I agree with him. So, for those of you who don't know much about me, I'm Tom Oliver. I farm with my mum and my brother in a beautiful little village in Herefordshire in England called Ochil Pitchard. We've got a 330-acre traditional mixed Herefordshire farm. It's extensive rather than intensive. We've got a 60-head herd of Hereford cattle, which we are a single suckler beef production. And we've got about 300 head of Texel sheep for fat lamb production. Most of the farm is down to grass. There's a bit of woodland, a little bit of corn, and a small amount of orchard. So I don't have a huge amount of fruit myself, but I luckily live in probably the finest county in the world for cider apples, and actually for perry pears. So I'm very lucky. We can source most of our fruit by helping people manage their orchards. And part of the payback is that I get the fruit in the sort of condition that I like for making the sort of cider and perry that I like to make. We decided to sell cider and perry in 1999. Until then, we've been hop growers. And two people up until then had been really important in my cider and perry making time. One was a chap called Roger French, who wrote a fantastic book called The History and Virtues of Cider. Has anyone read Roger's book at all? No, you should do. It published in 1983. He wrote about cider when nobody was interested in it, when nobody cared. And he brought a wonderful academic slant to it. It's a fantastic read. It's cerebral, and it's for taste, and it's highly recommended. You can get it on the usual book channels on the internet. He provided me with that eureka moment. He lives in a cottage in Checkley. It's a small cider maker's cottage. And if you can imagine, there's a kitchen which he dug a cellar out underneath by hand to store his cider and perry in. And it fills with water. So you can't have any electric down there. You have to go down with a torch and you retrieve bottles that are sort of moldy and fungus ridden. And one day he went down and he retrieved a bottle and it looked ghastly. You know, it looked like my early types of attempt at making cider and perry. And he prized the top off and offered me a glass, and it was glorious. It was aromatic. It was sparkling, but in a beautiful sort of sensory way. Lots of small bubbles. It was a phenomenal experience on the nose, and the taste was ballistic experience. It was a Kingston Black cider, and right at that moment, I knew that this was the style of drink that I wanted to make, and I've been trying to pursue that ever since. I've not actually recreated that experience with any of my ciders and perries yet, so I've got something to aim at, which is what it's all about. The other chap that helped me was a chap called Ted Jones. He lives in a place called Stamford Bishop in Bromyard. And him and me used to pick fruit in the same orchard. And I was allowed free run of the orchard, except for one tree. One tree. Okay. Sorry, while I was talking about my place, I was meant to show you the drive down to my cider house. For those of you who have been, the cattle might not have been at the top of the drive and it might not have been sunny when you were there. But it's a... You know, as much as I love cider and apples, when I look at that picture and I see the blue of the sky, the green of the grass, that beautiful deep red of the Hereford coat and the white face, I think you cannot get a better use of colours. There isn't. It is phenomenal. Makes me very proud to be from Herefordshire, I tell you. Okay. So, yeah, this one tree. I wasn't allowed to have the fruit. It was Ted's fruit. And he valued the perry that he made from this tree above all other trees. And I found out why. But it took quite a few years for me to find out. We discovered that this, in actual fact, is a variety called Copy. That tree that you're looking at is the only mature tree of this variety that is known. Now, that is known anywhere. So he clearly knew his varieties, but he clearly knew the qualities of a pear that made a fine drink. Unfortunately, Ted is now dead, but with that misfortune is my fortune, because I can now have the fruit and have done so for a number of years. You're looking at the mighty Copy tree, of which there is only one. We have, of course, grafted and budded it, and it is been spread around now, but still the only one that I know of. People keep coming up with faux copy pears, and it's great fun, because I really would love to find another one, but nobody has yet. Right. Okay. Those are a few copy perry pears, and they have really caught the sun. Beautiful, sort of like russeting and flushing. It speaks for itself. Okay. A little bit about the history of perry in the UK. It's a wonderfully undocumented and sort of guess game as to what actually happened. And excuse me if I sort of do a lot of reading here now, but if I don't, what I say will be rubbish and wrong. So let's try and get as factual as possible. At the end of the Ice Age, I have actually done a little bit of research on this, but I do like to thank a chap called Jim Chapman, who has provided me with quite a lot of information on this. At the end of the Ice Age, the wild pear, the Pyrus pyraster, started spreading across Europe. Okay, so this is post-Ice Age. We then leap to the Romans, and they started planting cultivars of Pyrus communis. But in this country, at least, these orchards did not survive the Dark Ages when the Romans left. So we've now leapt through to the Romans leaving the UK. And what happened was that their plantings went wild. The remaining pears self-seeded. They mingled with the existing wild pears, the Pyrus pyraster. So there was a feral population of chance seedlings, or wildings, that were starting to emerge. However, they became so common in some areas that the monk William of Malmesbury wrote at the start of the 12th century, and this was about Gloucestershire, "Here you may see the highways and the common lanes clad with apple trees and pear trees, not set nor grafted by the industry of man's hand, but growing naturally of their own accord." So really what they're saying is that pears, right up until sort of the middle ages of, say, let's 1400s, 1500s, they weren't growing. They just happened. So they would be in woods, they would be in hedgerows, but don't think of neatly planted orchards, okay? These were just trees in the wild, much like people in America seem fascinated by trees in the wild, and I'm somewhat envious, because in the UK now we have very few trees in the wild left in terms of apples, and certainly in terms of pears. But over here, I think with the space you have, they're still very much about the place, which is very good. So there's another topic that's quite relevant nowadays, and that's climate change. And so I need to try and weave in what was happening climatically in the UK at this time. There was a medieval warm period that made southern England suitable for growing grapes, and that lasted from 950 to 1250. So what fruit was grown for making drink was more likely to be grapes than apples or pears. Just trying to set the scene. We then had a short gap of 50 years, and then there was a little ice age from 1300 to 1850, right? And then this was where vineyards were replaced by orchards. So, starting to get the picture, orchards started to develop from the 1300s onwards. And this meant that in terms of Europe, you had the sort of corn-fed ale being made in the northern half. You had the grape-led winemakers in the southern half, and then in this little strip in the middle, you had the orchards and the apples and the pears. And that, in essence, is probably one of the most significant reasons why the West Country of England has the reputation it has, and while in Normandy has the reputation it has, because we just fitted in a band that didn't fit in the beer belt or the wine belt. Okay, so any orcharding skills that had been possessed by the Romans when they were planting, they were obviously lost as well at the same time. Right, so this was our neck of the woods. Let's move to the east. Peaceful government returned to the east a lot more quickly than it did in our area. So the knowledge and skills were preserved by Islamic invaders, and the fruit-growing culture assimilated into Moorish life. And this knowledge spread across northern Africa and the Mediterranean to return into Europe through Spain to France, where the majority of pears known today originated. So what we're saying is that there was a sort of wildness to the pears that were coming in the UK, in England, but there was also cultivated pears coming via this route. And this is all fairly contemporary thinking. It's still up for grabs, you know, as to what actually happened, but I'm just illustrating, hopefully, what's the way it came about. So a couple of little factoid type things. In England in the 13th century, Queen Eleanor of Provence the wife of Henry III, introduced the hard culinary pair, the Caelhu, to the royal gardens. Then another, Eleanor of Castile, the wife of Edward I, had an even greater influence, having brought her own gardeners from Spain, and the pairs she introduced were still hard ones that required cooking. And another hard, gritty pair that was introduced was the Warden, and that was introduced by the monks at Warden Abbey in Bedfordshire about 1388. So pears were introduced for their keeping qualities as much as for the fruit, and something like this rock-hard Warden pear would last well into the spring. And this was important for a couple of reasons. One is we hadn't yet discovered root crops, so turnips, swedes, parsnips, potatoes didn't exist. So fruit substituted for them, both as a source of vitamins and something to accompany meat. Okay, so you know we were making a bit of drink from it, but it was still had another principal use for pears. Coming into the 16th century, the sweet dessert pear that could be eaten raw was introduced, and this was by Thomas Harris, who was a fruiterer to Henry VIII. But you know, we still had these wild feral pears that existed as well. Okay, so everyone with me still?
Yep.
Getting a feel for what's going on, or not going on, as the case may be. Okay, so at the beginning of the 17th century, Perry was being made both from wild pears and cultivated pears, but the quality of the pears was probably not outstanding. But this was to change, and this was really where everything started to move. John Evelyn, one of the go-to writers that you would read if you're interested in cider and perry in the UK through the ages, and he records in 1664 that growers around May Hill, and this is a hill on the Gloucestershire-Herefordshire border, for those of you who've been there, Gloucestershire perry makers will tell you, boringly, that if you can't see May Hill from your perry orchard, then you won't make good perry. I would refute that, saying I can't see May Hill from my orchards, and I think I make okay perry. So let's set the record straight. Okay, so these growers around May Hill, though, were starting to select the best feral pears that made the best perry. We think that, in essence, the basis of the perry pears that exist nowadays, the selection process started there or thereabouts, in terms of seeking out the fruit that made the best perry. William Camden in Britannia, in 1586, he remarked upon the decline of vineyards in Gloucestershire and their replacement with orchards. Then there's no mention in his next edition, but in 1695, just over 100 years later, Herefordshire is then described as being eminent for all fruit, but especially providing cider, S-Y-D-E-R, for London. Okay, so you can see there's a gradual shift starting to develop. John Gerard, who was a herbalist, he wrote in 1597, wine made of the juice of pears was called English perry. And then in 1629, a herbalist, John Parkinson, noted that these choke pears, which were not found in orchards but in woods, hedges, and were vile to eat, but tasted pleasant after fermentation and maturation of a few months. He then mentioned that they were also being used on long voyages against scurvy. Okay, so there you go. Right. Next picture. So, there's a mighty fine tree. A little bit about this one, because it fits into this. Bless you. Writing in 1656, Reverend John Peel speaks of the neighbourhood of Bosbury in Herefordshire being famous for a pear so hard and coarse that even a pig will not eat it. That's some pear, isn't it? Yeah. Anyway, this fruit was called the Bearland pear, B-A-R-E-L-A-N-D, Bearland pear. Then, referring to some Harleian manuscripts, 6726 is the number if you want to look it up. This was a pear growing at Upledden in Bosbury, a farm called Barlands, was recorded as famous for a pear cider, P-E-A-R-E, cider. Okay, so all these words crop up. Upledden was the manor that belonged to the Order of the Knights of the Templars until they were suppressed. Rather than this pear being just another wilding, perhaps the Knights Templar might have bought this potentially foreign pear back, say from maybe Jerusalem or wherever they had been defending the country. And perhaps maybe they brought back something special. I don't know. Anyway, it's the very first mention of a named peripear variety, the Barland peripear. That tree is a Barland peripear tree.
Do we see the graft line?
You do. And it's not like the high horse graft line. It's a lower one about...
Well, we see something white there.
3 foot off the ground.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. And that tree, so the photograph's a bit of a, it makes that 30-foot bough. The 30-foot high barn makes the tree look like 150-foot high, but it's not quite that high, but it is magnificent, and especially when it's in blossom. And it's one of the wonderful sights you get around the three counties of Herefordshire, Worcestershire and Gloucestershire. Okay, so the Barland tree. Right. Any idea what time it is anymore?
It's about 5:11.
Is it? How much longer have I got?
We'll let you go as long as you can.
Okay. All right. So I'm just going to try and just mention a few other characters because the thing about Perry is it's a roller coaster ride. And individuals tended to crop up to help either resuscitate it or put Perry back on the right track when it drifted off. And usually that was with a view to managing orchards and looking after varieties and selecting the right varieties. So one very fine, well-meaning chap, Thomas Andrew Knight, 1759 to 1838. He's the father of modern pomology, as far as we're concerned, and he wrote the Pomona Herefordiensis, and that describes varieties of Perry pears and cider apples. Robert Hogg and Henry Bull, they compiled a beautiful Hereford Pomona at the behest of the Reverend Charles Bulmer, who was father to the two brothers who started Bulmer Cider. And there's a beautiful book with paintings done by his niece and his another one's daughter, I think. That is on display at the Cider Museum in Hereford, and that is all known varieties of apple and pear in the county at the time, and it's an extraordinary, extraordinary book. We also had a Charles Radcliffe Cook, who was known as the MP for Cider, and he wrote a fine book called The Apple and Pear as Vintage Fruits, and that was published during the Depression to encourage farmers to take cider and perry seriously. And we then, very, very luckily for us, had people like Ted Barker and Herbert Durham, Ray Williams, Mr. Luckwell, Mr. Pollard, Mr. Fred Beach, who were all working at Long Ashton Research Station in Bristol, who probably have put more information on cider apples, peri pears, and cider and peri than any other institution so far, and their loss is very, very much missed. And I hope that one of the things that will happen in the future is we get back to some real bona fide science research because we need it. Modern times, Charles Martel's written a fabulous book on the pears of Gloucestershire. And as I say, Mr. Jim Chapman, who very kindly gave me a lot of this information, he's now what I call a modern day benefactor of cider and perry. Perry, mostly. Okay, that's that.
That's me with a perry pear. Yeah.
That's Mr. Jim Chapman holding his back. And that there is a display of peri pears That was this year, third weekend of September, at the Morvan Autumn Show, and there are over 90 different varieties of peri-pear on display there. I'm going to try and weave this in as I talk. I've got pictures of 70 different peri-pears coming up. And I'm not going to spend time talking about individual ones or anything, but I'm just going to every now and then whiz through a few so you can see what the varieties look like. If you've maybe just heard names in the past, you can have a look at what they actually look like. Okay, on to peri making. The first thing is, the way I make, and this applies to cider and peri, I'm totally reliant on the fruit I have. For those of you who've been to see my operation, it is hardly the height of cleanliness and so forth. So I'm reliant on peri pears and cider apples. I don't work with baking pears, eating pears, dessert pears, culinary pears. It's peri pears. And I think the qualities of the raw material allow me to make cider and peri the way I do. I'm making small batches. I'm all about minimum intervention. I don't do anything unless I have to. Why would you? I ferment ambiently with wild yeast. Don't pitch yeast. I don't use any sulfur prior to fermentation. Though I will say that after last year's three totes of mousy peri, I am thinking hard about maybe I need to, on occasion, think about using sulfur prior to fermentation. But I'm only thinking about it, all right? I'm not convinced yet. I would rather take a few losses and get the basic results I do if I can. I would really like that. I don't use any yeast nutrient, and we don't pitch any yeast. So you can see we're pretty basic. I use a little moderate amount of SO2 at bottling, between 30 and 80 parts per million. I think it's good for something to scavenge for oxygen once you've packaged, and helps keep the old peri fresh in the bottle a little bit. I don't use any SO2 on the bottle conditioned peris that I make, so that's good. By volume, about 60% of my peri is sold on draft, and about 40% is packaged in bottle, in glass. I do still carbonated, bottle conditioned, or bottle fermented. Just starting to do a little bit of kegging too. Blending, it's all done in the mouth on the palate. And I think one of the things about peri is, they say don't mix different pears because things can go wrong. And I think that's one of the things that's you learn about the pears that you work with. Some you can blend without any issues. Others, it throws up hazes and so forth. So you just have to be aware of your fruit. That's what I reckon. And that's basically about what I do. I'm going to talk now about a few topics in terms of the way we grow fruit, harvest fruit, and then in the cider house when we're actually making peri. Just to give you once again a picture of the fruit that we are working with and what's happening, hopefully, it as a general overview as well. Okay. Arlingham squash. Don't ever plant squash. One of the great pears that you can never quite get to grips with. You think you've got it all lined up ready to harvest or collect, and then you get around to getting them and they've all gone soft and impossible to work with. It does make great peri, but I suggest it's for those people who could really pay attention to detail that becomes a worthwhile variety. That's the old bad boy, the Bearland Barland pear, the first named peri pear variety. Edwin from Plowman Cider came and helped me a few weeks ago, and when he went back told his kids that he'd been pressing butt pears all day. it's humour like that that misses us English, And when I saw him at the Cider Museum a week later, the kids were still laughing. It was great. So, There is humor in Perry, yeah. Okay. All right, so out in the orchard. Obviously, I love big standard trees. We have some still. We have less than we used to have. And generally, at the moment, the prevalent planting of Perry pears is on more bush-style trees because everyone is determined to try and make this particular fruit give them an income. I am in admiration of all those people who are trying to make growing Perry pears give them an income. It is a really, really dangerous pursuit. It's more dangerous than deep sea diving. It's more dangerous than filming sharks. It's just not a guarantee, but it's worth a go. We tend to see the plantings that happen nowadays that are sort of 300 trees per acre. Trees are about 8 foot apart, and rows are about 16 foot apart. The favoured rootstock at the moment, and you know, there's a number, as you all know, everybody knows people who are using this, that, and the other. Kirchensteiler in the UK, a German rootstock. They're getting pretty decent results in terms of the growth of the tree. There still seems to be some varieties that seem to thrive on dwarfing, and there's others that seem not to particularly enjoy a dwarfing result. Blakeney Red doesn't seem that happy. As a dwarfing tree, which is a pity because it's a wonderful workhorse Perry pear. It's like in the UK, it's like the equivalent to the Dabinet cider apple. You know, it's a good yielder, it's a good size, it's a regular cropper, and it's got some really nice Perry making qualities. But it's not particularly in love from what we're seeing at the moment in a bush situation. Just to say, in terms of what pears can grow to, if anyone's comes and visits, and I've got like loads of time, one of the visits we do is down to the house where Lord Scudamore lived, and he's the chap responsible for planting the Red Streak apple in Herefordshire. Or encouraging, I don't think he probably ever planted a single thing in his life, but he instructed others to plant the Red Streak apple. And responsible for the phrase that Herefordshire was but one entire orchard. He lived down at Home Lacey, and his house is luckily preserved. It's now a hotel for people over 60, so I can go there. Down by the river, there's the old rooted branches of a Perry pear tree, and these rooted branches are all that's left from a tree that in where's the year, Tom? 1790. This tree had a canopy covered 3/4 of an acre. I hope we all know acres, yeah. And it yielded 7 UK metric tons of fruit. You can imagine that, 7 tons of fruit off one tree. Job done. You know. So it's not like that in reality, is it, at all? Anyway, and I've never seen a tree yield anything like that. So maybe that's consigned to history now, I don't know. Okay, so with these young bush-grown trees too, I have reservations about the quality of the fruit coming off them. Sugar levels are low, and the character of finished Perry is a little light. I don't say it's not workable with or anything, but it's a little light compared to these big old standard trees. And there's any number of reasons why this is the case, but it's, for me, it's a fact that that's the case, and you have to then work around these situations. So we'll go and flick through a few more varieties now, but if anyone's interested, what my favourite varieties for making Perry, hopefully from old trees, Moorcroft, wonderful variety, early variety, bit of a devil, some fall, some don't. tendency to rot from the, sorry, not rot, bled from the inside out. Another early one, Thorn, big fan of Thorn. Blakeney Red, Hendry Huffcap, Winnells Longdon, a real bletting from the inside out, devil of a pair to pick. Copy, Rock, Gin, Oldfield. Those last four are pretty good. Later season, reasonable croppers, as far as Perry pairs go, and all make wonderful single variety Perrys, all very blendable. You just got to watch Rock. Always do Rock on its own. If you get hold of Rock, you'll know it. You'll know you've got it. Okay, flick through a few more. Christmas pear, named for a clear reason. Cypress pear. That's a lovely looking pear. In fact, it looks very much like the pear used on Eve's cider label, which I think is a beautiful label, by the way. And it's a beautiful perry too. Barrett, clusters, copy. See, nothing like as beautiful as the ones I showed you on the slide earlier. But same idea. Cowslip, beautiful. Dead boy. There's a reason for that name. It's you have to drink it to know why.
Duck's Barn, Blunt Red, Early Griffin, Flaky Bark.
What a, it's, that's the Madai door of the Perry Pear world. Yeah.
Gin, Green Horse, Green Longdon, Green Roller.
There's one tree of Green Roller left on the drive down to Helen's house in Much Markle. Once again, it's obviously been propagated, but yeah, one mature tree of Green Roller. By the way, I do assure you that if I was flicking through these without the names on them, I wouldn't have a clue what they all were. All right? Well, I'd know a few, but yeah, the challenge of the Perry Pear. They all ripen at different times. You know, they don't come off the tree, and they have this wonderful thing of bletting. So people ask me, you know, this pear's going brown from the inside out. You know, is it a bad thing? Is it, you know, well, it's not a bad thing. It's what happens. You know, and bletting is a softening, and it's not rotting. It's actually fermentation. And it just takes pears beyond ripe. It brings an increase in sugars, which you can tell by the smell, and a decrease in the acids and tannins that cause this unique, this unripe fruit to be astringent. So, and blet is derived from the French pois blet, meaning overripe pear. So, Claude's let me get away with that one, that's good. And rot, on the other hand, is decomposed due to biological action, usually fungal or bacterial. So there is a difference. So what I'm really saying is I'm not afraid of using pears that are bletty from the inside out. And I tell you, the qualities of the juice are wonderful. But it's how far you let it go. And that's always going to be one of your calls when you're making perry. Okay. Yeah.
How do you press them?
With a little more difficulty than normal. Yeah. So, Claude, it's a good point. I'm just coming on to that one. Generally, we do not we don't sweat pears, not on purpose anyway. Obviously, sometimes we just don't get around to things as quickly as we'd like to. But we do like what happens when the sugars concentrate and a bit of water is lost. Washing, yes. We wash pears before we mill them, and Mike Beck is a clever man. He uses a saline solution to float his pears, because pears sink generally, unlike apples, which float generally. Yeah, that's a good way to get your pears through your water course to your mill. We're always looking for good, chunky, thick sort of porridge consistency when we're milling. So there's quite a lot of grater changing in the mill by Yarick when he's doing pears. He doesn't really like doing pears because it's a fiddle, but he is good. He does try and get the sort of consistency that we want for getting a good press going. And as Claude says, a lot of these pears are not particularly easy to press, particularly in belt presses and maybe pack presses. It may be where sort of the wine style presses actually are quite useful. But whatever, they always slip out somewhere, slime somewhere, stick somewhere. There's a couple of ways around it. I know people over here use rice hulls to help, give some sort of texture to the pomace to let the juice get out. But we tend to add back in fibrous pears, so we have a lot of butt. Sorry, it's true, and pears. And I'm laughing at my own. One way around it is if you add back in some of these more fibrous pears onto some of the more slimy pears, it actually helps a lot. It's quite a simple thing to do. That's something we did a lot of this year. Maceration, absolutely vital, probably the one most key thing to making perry. Maceration is that leaving the pears after you've milled them before you press them. I can't give you the science on this because I'm not a scientist and I don't have to, but if you will take my word for it, that by macerating pears, even if it's not in vessels that are, technically, only the top couple of inches of anything actually oxidize or do what full maceration is. But anything left out in any vessel of any depth for a 24-hour period or even 48 hours when you're doing pears will be of benefit. Sometimes it doesn't benefit the pressing. Slimy is still slimy. But it will benefit you in the finished perry in the bottle. It will help in terms of the wonderful gift that perry has that will keep giving in terms of the tannins that will return when you think you've got a wonderfully clear perry and you've bottled it and it's your pride and joy. And then months later, the snow scene starts developing in time for next Christmas. And it's a little frustrating. I mean, there's no bearing whatsoever on the quality of the perry in the bottle. It just doesn't look as nice. And we're trying to make drinks that look nice as well. So I'm getting a bit thirsty, but Lauren's just going to bring around the second perry. Yeah, I can.
So when you macerate, what sorts of vessels are you macerating in? Are you just leaving it in... Okay. Like a 5-gallon bucket and only the top is exposed, or are you putting it in something that's shallow?
Okay. I'd need a lot of 5-gallon buckets, all right? So what we're doing is I've got, I call them a bath. They're not a bath, but they're vessels that long, that wide, that deep, and I got, like a dozen of them. It doesn't really matter. It can be a tank, it can be anything. It's just the fact that you leave it for that period that I think is the benefit. Ideal would be, I've seen them in France or Italy, great big stainless steel vessels with a centrifuge pump in the bottom that will then pull the... Do I mean centrifuge? No, I mean... thank you. Yeah. We'll bring it back out into your mill. And they're that deep, but they're huge. I mean, it can take up not a room this size, but that sort of size. But ideal, but no, not vital at all. Any container to rest them in is good.
How long?
24 to 48 hours. The great thing about it is... You can use this to fit into a system. It's not a system that large producers find easy because all they want to do is just get things moving. But you know what we do is we would mill at the end of the day, as we before we finish up, then leave it overnight. And yes, when we come back to it, it may not be 24 hours, or it may be 36 type hours later. It does really help. Typically, you know, tannin levels after 24 hours will drop by 2/3, and that's wonderful. You know, that's a massive help. And so not just tannin dropping, but as I say, that wonderful colloidal thing that will happen in bottle later is minimized as well. Okay, so I've told you I don't use sulfur, I don't use yeast. I'm a big fan of the complexity that these types of fermentations come. I love the randomness of wild yeast, the succession of wild yeast. Typically, we start off with yeast from the fruit, which are apiculate yeast, as a general rule. They are the ones that kick the fermentations off, do 1-2% of alcohol, and then you shift over to the Saccharomyces, and they're the workhorse ones that carry on and finish the fermentation off. In terms of where these yeasts come from, people say, you know, is it all on the fruit? Where is it? Well, it's not all on the fruit. The general consensus at the moment is about 5% of a wild yeast population working on a fermentation will come from the fruit. 2% on the fruit, 3% in the fruit. That leaves 95% of the yeasts that work on a wild yeast population will be from the equipment and in the buildings. And you know, therefore, immediately everyone goes, that's why Tom has the sort of buildings he has in the sort of conditions he has them. Because that's what works, or that's what has worked, that's what is working, and that's what I really hope carries on working. I take nothing for granted, but it works. Okay. Peri pears too, notoriously depleted in nitrogen. So you would think maybe something you should add to, but I personally don't. I love long, slow fermentations. If I had to pick one peri pear, it would probably be Oldfield. It is, and I use this lightly, it is almost the Kingston Black of the peri pear world. Obviously completely different characteristics, but a single variety peri from Oldfield is fabulous. Okay, so tannins, we talked a little bit about them and how to avoid the issues that come with them, and it is important, I think, to really take care of the tannin levels in your in from your peri pears. They make they're the deal breakers, really, and they're the things you want to concentrate on. And maceration is the key to that. Citric acid, that's another gift that keeps giving with peri pears. The real issue with that is that anaerobically, in the presence of lactic acid bacteria, that can be converted into acetic acid / vinegar. So the one of the predominant acids in some pears has this wonderful ability, even if you make peri in the most fastidious conditions, to go down to acetic acid and vinegar. And I'm very hopeful that the gentleman from Austria tomorrow will tell us a little bit about why it is they adopt the techniques they use when they make peri, because I think they're absolutely petrified of that particular pathway. Sorbitol, it's the reason a dry peri, as in all sugars that are fermentable in the peri pears, have been fully fermented, and you're still left with some lovely residual sweetness. That's down to sorbitol. It is an unfermentable sugar, and it is a number of other things as well. The main one being a diuretic. Some people are more sensitive to it than others. It is the reason that the reputation for some pears went along the lines of it goes in like velvet and out like thunder. I reserve Homer Perry for my very special guests on that. So once again, if you visit and I offer you a Homer Perry, maybe you will ask, have you upset me? Or are you indeed somebody who's probably just had a very fine meal and wants to... Anyway, sorry. English humour. Yeah. Thank you to Ryan for his Perry. And the second one was my classic Perry. It's a medium sweet Perry. Just a mix of Perry pears and a little back sweetening. And I hope it sort of wet your whistle. Well, nothing to do. It's the finest of drinks, but what is Perry? You know, just what is it? What is it? So, in 1663, the Reverend John Beale, who was a founding fellow of the Royal Society and a cider scribe, observed that Perry was most pleasing to the female palate. So, possibly it is a drink for the ladies. Nice. Perry was also used to bulk up poor wine stocks when we were at war with the French. And as we were always at war with the French, we used a lot of Perry. But it was... So, Perry is something for the unscrupulous wine merchant. Okay. It's also reputed that it was Napoleon Bonaparte's favourite drink, talking of the French. And indeed, he did call Perry the English champagne. And his phrase is, in victory, you deserve champagne. In defeat, you need it. Well, that could... Uh-oh, here's another really bad one. That could well have been his Waterloo. Okay. So it is a drink for ill-fated leaders of men. All right. So here we go round. 1953, the first alcoholic product to be advertised on television in the UK. It's extraordinary to think that. Baby Sham, the genuine champagne Perry. And indeed, in the early years, it was just what it said. Sold in tiny bottles with these old-style champagne glasses. So, it's a drink for the sophisticated. In 2005, Matthew Fort, a food critic and writer, described my Perry as... debonair as a Savile Row suit with a long, long finish. So it is a drink for the fashionable. All right. Anyway, what I know is that Perry is not pear cider. I'm happy for it to exist because it means that anything that's not made from Perry pears can be called pear cider. But I want Perry to be made from Perry pears. Perry is a drink that has the potential to outstrip many overpriced champagnes, but it's fuller fruitiness, it's more exotic aroma and altogether richer taste. I think a still fine dry Perry, when drunk with a Thomas Crump single Gloucester cheese or a Bob Keane Somerset cheddar, is a sublime experience. No wedding is complete without some sparkling Perry to toast the bride and groom. However, the scarcity of the raw material of Perry pear and some of the difficulties that making Perry presents is always an issue. And it means that in the UK we've seen a sort of continual rise and fall, roller coaster ride of Perry, which is probably not really going to change much. Finally, who drinks Perry? I'm not referring to you here. So there's a few people you might recognise in that picture. 2004, I've not aged, but Peter Mitchell has. And Prince Charles certainly has. But he was enjoying a Perry there, and he's a very fine supporter of it. And I do believe that at that particular Salone, or it may have been the next one, was the very first time that I met Nicole Lebon from Farnham Hill and Charles McGonagall from Appletree in Wisconsin. And we had an impromptu tasting in the car park because there was no room at the Salone in Turin for us to have a get together. It was a bit like how I think Franklin County Cider Days is. It's a happenstance of people coming together to enjoy something that they're really, really proud of. And that meeting in the car park was fantastic. We felt a little bit like the outsiders, and you know, that we didn't have a place at the party. But we had a wonderful tasting, an enthused discussion about cider and perry. And this was going back to 2004. Nicole might correct me, it may have been a year or two later, but it seems like a long time ago, but it was a very wonderful experience. The second person. Oh, dear. Anyway, it doesn't matter. He stands for himself. It was Robert Plant, singer with Led Zeppelin. Down at the cider house. I was going to sing you Stairway to Heaven. So the good thing is I'm not singing Stairway to Heaven. I'm finishing now. Thanks very much for listening.
Thank you, Tom Oliver of Oliver's Cider and Perry, for sharing such a wealth of information on that delectable drink we know as Perry and those persnickety palms called Perry Pears. Oh, we love them so. And if you haven't made a note yet, please do to reserve your space now on the Totally Cider Tour headed to the UK on April 25th through May 2nd, right in the middle of apple blossom time. And again, we will be meeting up with Tom Oliver. So that's fantastic. Just go to totallycider.com. Well, I am a little weary, so I'm going to go take a rest and roll out of here so I could get ready for next week's episode to bring to you, because there's a lot of humdingers right up on the queue and so many people to speak to. In fact, if you are headed to CiderCon, as another little reminder, do contact me. I have some openings still with makers, so perhaps it will work out having that chat with you. And if I can't get to you, please do not be offended. Just know that there is always a spot for you on this podcast. It's just a matter of time. So many stories. I love hearing them all, and we'll be getting to them. So bear with me as we, you know, make our way around Ciderville, because it is one big world. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Going up, going up.
Yeehaw!